I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There have been more than 200 mass shootings in the United States this year alone. When it comes to what we know about who commits these crimes, there are some hard truths and misconceptions. Today, a panel of reporters from the Guns in America Project walk us through the facts and the myths, learn about red flag laws, if there is such a thing as a profile of a mass shooter, how they obtain guns, and the warning signs to look for before people become violent. Then, El Paso was site of one of the mass shootings last week, and the shooter is reported to have targeted the Hispanic community. We'll ask Latinos about what this open attack means for them. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. America is worried sick once again about the prospect of public mass shootings like those in El Paso and Dayton, and for good reason. But it never hurts to have a little context for terrifying incidents like this. Mass shootings make up a very small percentage of annual gun deaths in America. In fact, it's less than 1%. Turns out there are lots of misconceptions out there about mass shooters, who they are, and how they operate. Now, a conversation with three members of NPR's Guns in America team about this phenomenon of the mass shooter and the ways the country is gearing up to stop them. With us today, Aditi Bandlamudi is based in at North Carolina Public Radio. That's WUNC. Good morning.
Morning.
Lee Patterson is based at KUNC in Northern Colorado. She joins us from Denver this morning. Lee, good morning.
Hello there.
Chris Axel is our Guns in America reporter based here at KCUR, and he's sitting right across from me here in the studio. Chris, good morning.
Hey, Steve.
Chris, I want to begin with last night's forum that Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver sponsored to end gun violence. Mayor Lucas was there. I believe Police Chief Rick Smith was as well. Tell me about it. I mean, how many people showed up? What were their concerns? What happened?
I'd say there were 200, maybe 250 folks there. A significant majority of them were clearly gun activists, or I should say gun control activists, many of them wearing the red T-shirt of Mothers in Charge Against Gun Violence, or orange T-shirt of Grandparents Against Gun Violence, or the black T-shirt of the Mothers in Charge group, which is based here in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. You know, how much hope did the congressman, how much hope was he able to offer about the prospect of Congress passing something down the road of gun control in the months to come?
He didn't really speak directly in terms of making a prediction, but sort of reading between the lines, I mean, he seems hopeful. He spoke pretty forcefully, and he said now is the time for action. You know, he said there's a time for praying and this ain't it. And really, it was sort of a call to action to get the people in the room to go out and talk to other people about what they think, you know, needs to happen and to get gun control passed.
So the Reverend was saying it's not a time to pray.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything that surprised you about the forum? Anything that was unexpected?
I mean, overall, I was a little surprised at how many of the speakers spoke directly to the need to lobby lawmakers. For a long time here in Kansas City, you know, we hear kind of malaise regarding the guns availability. You know, you hear now former Mayor Sly James frequently would talk about the problem with the state's gun laws, but he never seemed like he believed there could be action that could be taken. I got a slightly different sense last night.
A more optimistic tone from those who favor that kind of thing.
For sure. Saying.
I wonder, for all three of you here joining me this morning, if you can talk about what a difficult issue this is, this idea of gun control and finding some way to do more to stop mass shootings. I mean, people throw out ideas, but there are always seem to be someone on the other end saying, yeah, but that won't work, and here's a study to prove it. Adito, you know, how tough of a nut is this to crack?
You know, here in North Carolina, you know, we're trying to pass, or well, here in North Carolina, there are Democrats, Democratic lawmakers who are trying to pass a red flag law, but they're receiving a lot of opposition. And, you know, so far, no Republicans have signed onto the bill, and it's sort of been stuck in committee.
Lee, how about you out in Denver?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, politics aside, I would just say that one thing to remember is that gun violence isn't just one problem with one solution. The causes and solutions for firearm suicide, for example, are different than the causes and solutions for domestic homicide, different than the causes and solutions for mass shootings. So that's, you know, just one out of the many reasons why gun violence broadly is just a really difficult problem to tackle.
I was going to say, Leah, and that makes it really tough for politicians because this is a problem with many facets to it, and it's not easy to solve. And those make maybe for the toughest politics out there.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so not only is this a multifaceted problem with many causes and solutions, it's hyper-partisan, hyper-polarizing for both politicians and for their constituents. There are, of course, many, many strong feelings all around.
How tough of a nut is this to crack in your mind, Chris?
I mean, there are all sorts of facets to different types of gun violence, but there's a common denominator, and that's guns. I mean, the U.S. has more guns per capita than any country in the world. And so to me, it comes back to the laws and the politics. I mean, that's one change that could be made.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Lee, there's all this talk this week now about this new term in our culture, red flag laws, in the wake of the carnage last weekend. What is a red flag law?
Yeah, sure. So red flag laws, sometimes they're called extreme risk protection orders. There are a couple of different names, but essentially what these laws do, they allow family members, law enforcement to go to a judge and say, hey, I'm worried about someone, you know, maybe a family member or a loved one. I'm worried that they're a significant risk to themselves or others. Here's why. If the judge agrees and grants the order, then that individual has to temporarily give up their firearms, and they're generally temporarily barred from buying new ones. So that's essentially kind of the broad strokes of how red flag laws work.
So Lee, just to be clear, they have to give up what they have and they can't buy anything new?
Generally, yes. But again, the laws do vary state to state.
Kid, are there certain things the law does not do that people should be aware of?
Well, again, because laws vary state to state, I have to speak in generalities. Right. But here in Colorado, one of the criticisms is that the Extreme Risk Protection Order law here, which has not taken effect yet, it was signed into law this past legislative session this spring. There's not a mental health component. You know, there's no kind of like forced mental health treatment or care once those firearms are temporarily taken away. So that was a big criticism of the law here.
It doesn't go far enough in the eyes of some, then, you're saying?
It doesn't go far enough in terms of mental health care.
Ah. So you're suggesting, though, these laws are in place in some states, Lee? Am I hearing that correctly?
Yeah. At Guns in America's most recent count, they are in place in 17 states plus the District of Columbia. For the most part, these are fairly new laws. Many of them were passed in the aftermath of the Parkland school shooting. So, you know, data is still being gathered on how often they're used and for what. But they're becoming more and more common. Absolutely.
I was going to say, if they're new, we probably don't have a whole lot of data yet on how effective these things can be.
It's true, but we actually can look to Connecticut. Connecticut's had one of these laws since 1999.
Oh, wow.
It was put in place after a workplace shooting at the Connecticut Lottery, actually. So we can look at that state data, and what that state data shows is that the red flag law in the books there has been used for all sorts of things, violent threats against schools, against coworkers, intimate partners, but that law, in over half of cases, has to do with a suicide risk. So we talk about red flag laws in the context of mass shootings, and oftentimes that's exactly, you know, when they are passed. But they're used more often for suicide prevention, which of course makes sense because suicide is a much more common type of gun violence than mass shootings.
You know, Lee, we're talking about these red flag laws in the context of individual states, but could there, in theory, be a national red flag law?
There could, and there's been talk about that this past week. Senator Lindsey Graham says he will introduce a bipartisan federal red flag law, which would essentially be a grant program that would help states fund their own red flag laws. And grant money would go to law enforcement so that law enforcement could then hire mental health care professionals that would help law enforcement navigate when to use this red flag law, when it would be appropriate, and how best to use it. So that is certainly something that is under discussion right now, but there's no legislation as of yet.
You know, and just thinking about this a little bit, I can begin to see pretty quickly where a law like this has the potential, at least, for abuse, right? You want to stick it to somebody, you can make a case and mess with somebody's guns.
Yeah, and that is certainly a concern that some people have. The difficult thing, again, number one, because these laws are fairly new, we don't have a ton of data. And not all states keep records on when one of these orders is denied. So it's a little bit difficult to quantify those concerns.
I'm struck, and maybe you covered this already, that even some gun rights supporters oppose these red flag laws. Was that because of the lack of the mental health component, or are there other issues with it that gun rights supporters also have?
Well, sure, there's the mental health component, but I think generally red flag laws, extreme risk protection order laws, they do limit access to guns in a way, even right. simply in a temporary way. So if you're a person who believes in absolute access, you might have a problem with this law. I think the other common criticism is that red flag laws, extreme risk protection order laws violate due process. And that's because during that initial hearing, when the judge decides whether or not to issue an order, the person who's the subject, the person who could have their guns taken away, is not at that hearing. Then there's a second hearing, you know, a week or two later, that the subject can be there. They can make their case. Here's why I should have my guns back. And then the judge makes a decision whether to give those guns back or whether to extend the order. So the due process thing is another issue that people bring up.
That's interesting. Chris Haxel, do we have red flag laws in Kansas and Missouri?
We do not, Steve.
Any talk about these in the state capitals, or is it too early to tell?
I mean, Democratic legislators in both states have proposed red flag bills in recent years, but they didn't get anywhere. I think it's too early to tell whether there's a chance, you know, in the next legislative session.
But they've been proposed in the past.
They have been introduced.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to a different topic here, video games. Lots of talk that violent shoot 'em up video games can be a direct cause of violence. Is there any truth to that?
Well, according to researchers, there's no linear connection between the kinds of violent video games a person plays, how much time they spent playing them, and whether a person exhibits violent behavior.
Just flat out. It's pretty clear cut, it sounds like you're saying.
There's just no linear connection. There's not a really clear correlation between the two.
So when politicians make the correlation, then what? They're just supposing that this is the case?
Well, I was talking with a researcher from Oxford earlier this week about this idea and where it comes from. And he was saying that a lot of people who are maybe older, who haven't had direct contact with video games, but maybe haven't played with them, tend to have these simplistic views of how video games can affect behavior. And what researchers are finding is that it's a little more nuanced than that. There's not a direct connection between the two.
That's interesting. Chris Haxel, this surprised me. Turns out there's no one definition of a mass shooting. Why is that?
I mean, there are different organizations compiling their own lists, and those organizations have different standards.
And they include different incidents compared to the other groups.
Right. So in recent days, you may have seen the number 249 or 250 thrown about. That's referencing the list created by the Gun Violence Archive, which is a nonprofit that tracks all sorts of gun violence.
And what's their standard for measuring this, or do you know?
It's pretty expansive. It's basically if four or more people are killed in any shooting incident. So that could include gang violence or domestic incidents, that sort of thing.
And other groups have a higher number that they use?
There are. Mother Jones is another group that, you know, that's a media outlet, but they have a database which is similar in terms of numbers, but they have a few more exclusions. It has to be in a public place. There has to be evidence that the shooter was trying to commit some sort of, you know, indiscriminate mass murder, that sort of thing.
So the bottom line here is if our listeners hear the term mass shootings, they should know it might mean different things to different people.
Absolutely.
Okay. Lee, is there a specific profile that mass shooters have that makes them easier to spot ahead of time?
Well, I wouldn't say that there's a specific profile, but there are definitely traits and behaviors that many of these shooters have in common. The FBI looks at this stuff. They've analyzed active shooter situations from 2000 to 2013. So I can talk a little bit about that analysis. The FBI found that the majority of active shooters obtained their firearms legally. Around 25% of them had been diagnosed with some sort of mental illness. Oftentimes these shooters were experiencing stressors, you know, like job loss or maybe going through a breakup. And, you know, this is important. Many of them had exhibited concerning behaviors, you know, like aggressive interactions with other people, or what's called quote unquote leakage of violent intent, which means, you know, talking to someone else about being violent or posting online.
Is there any advice offered if people observe that about a loved one? What do you do? Okay, you observe it, then what?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the advice from the FBI would be something along the lines of say something.
Yeah.
Call your local law enforcement, which can be difficult to do if this is a family member or a loved one you're talking about. But if this is a school shooter situation, for example, some schools have mechanisms in place to gather complaints, sometimes anonymously. In Colorado, there's a program called Safe to Tell, which is an anonymous reporting system. Mm-hmm. So it depends on where you live. It depends on what's available to you. But definitely something that keeps coming up again and again is that these shooters do talk about their plans. They do exhibit concerning behaviors. But oftentimes there isn't then someone reporting what these individuals are saying.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking this morning about misconceptions surrounding mass shooters in the wake of the weekend's horrifying events. If you have a question for our good panel from the Guns in America Project at NPR, give us a shout, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Diddy, what do we know about the connection between mass shooters and the mentally ill? I mean, for gun violence in general, do we know how big a role mental illness plays?
So I think we want to be careful of how we talk about mental illness as it relates to mass shootings, because the majority of mental health symptoms are not related to gun violence. The University of Texas's medical branch did a study where it looked at different symptoms, including stress, anxiety, depression, hostility, PTSD, borderline personality disorder, and they found no relation between those symptoms and gun violence behavior. As Lee was talking about earlier, there are other sort of behaviors that you can look for, like, you know, being aggressive. Access to firearms is another big thing. But we want to be very, very careful when we talk about mental illness and gun violence and whether that's a predictor for violence.
That strikes me as so interesting. I think it's going to surprise people. I think a lot of folks, even with the findings about video games, a lot of people just assume there's a connection and they would think the same thing about mental illness.
It's definitely talked about a lot. And I think that we just need to have a more nuanced idea of what, you know, how these factors affect each other. I think we just need to be a little careful of how we relate the two.
Chris, staying with the mass shooter idea here, how many mass shooters have planned their attacks out and how many don't? What do we know about that?
So going back to the FBI study that Lee referenced earlier, they took a look at several dozen mass shooting incidents between 2000 and 2013, kind of did as much, you know, they looked into the old FBI files, that sort of thing, to try to answer that exact question. And basically they found that in about 75% of the cases, the shooters spent a week or longer planning before the attack.
So most of the time they do plan the attack.
Absolutely.
And pretty meticulously, it sounds like.
Yep.
Yeah. What do we know about where mass shooters get their guns?
Again, going back to that FBI study where they looked at all of these incidents, yeah. I believe 85% of the incidents, they either already possessed the guns or they got them from a family member or they went out and purchased them specifically before the shooting.
Okay, so as we begin to sort of wrap this up, where do the three of you think the country is going now with all this? Lee, I'll begin with you. Any sense of what you expect to happen from a political or governmental standpoint the next few months or how the country's going to respond here?
Sure. Well, as we were discussing before, there is some interest and enthusiasm around a possible red flag, federal red flag bill. And this past week, some congressional Republicans were signaling their support for that type of federal legislation. Now, this is not the first time a federal red flag bill has come up. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican, and Senator Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut have talked about this before. They've held hearings. And so this is, the idea is simply becoming relevant again. The NRA has commented, the organization told the New York Times yesterday that if there was going to be any sort of red flag order, there would at minimum have to be strong due process protections, mm-hmm. require mental health treatment, include penalties against those who make frivolous claims. But so despite this coalescing, perhaps, real gun policy is hyper controversial and hyper partisan. So making any predictions on a red flag gun bill is just, an unknown at this point.
For any of you, is that one of the key players here, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, he issued a statement either yesterday or this morning talking about this and what the approach might be, at least as far as the Senate's concerned. What did he say? Is there any reason to think there might be movement on his part there, Chris?
There have been calls. Hundreds of Democratic legislators have signed on to a letter asking McConnell to bring the Senate back from recess to vote on this universal background check bill, which the House passed back in February. Mm-hmm. He indicated a willingness to at least have some sort of conversation about that. It's unclear at this point if he's actually going to bring them back from recess. And if a vote does take place, We don't know if they have enough votes to pass it anyway.
I couldn't help but notice a new poll out yesterday by Morning Consult. It showed that 7 in 10 voters, including 54% of Republicans, said they support a ban on assault-style weapons. Pretty heavy majority there, Adita.
Well, I think it's and you know, going back to your previous question, like, I think it's a little too early to tell where politics is going to go in terms of passing any sort of real gun legislation, because it's very controversial, it's very partisan, and it's just a tricky thing I think people are grappling with.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank our three reporters from the Guns in America Project, Aditi Bandlamudi, Lee Patterson, and Chris Haxel from here at KCUR. Thanks for your insights. Thanks for your reporting, and keep going.
Thank you. Steve.
Thanks so much.
When we come back, we're going to talk about how local Latinos are reacting to last weekend's mass shooting in El Paso. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we discussed the signs and symptoms of dementia and Alzheimer's. Hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Well, the first edition of my email newsletter came out this week. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske to get exclusive content from me and highlights from the up-to-date team in your inbox. It'll take you 10 seconds. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to subscribe. That's kcur.org/Kraske. El Paso remains in mourning following a weekend mass shooting that left 22 dead at a Walmart, while the white suspect with the white suspect warning of an Hispanic invasion. President Trump's visit to the city Wednesday reportedly did little to ease tensions. We wondered how the Missouri and Kansas Latino communities are reacting. What are their thoughts and fears in the wake of this horrific event aimed at them? With us are two former residents of El Paso. Sandra Enriquez is an assistant professor in the Department of History, and she's affiliated with the Latinx and Latin American Studies program at UMKC. Sandra, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Vicky Diaz-Camacho is the community reporter for Flatland KC over at KCPT. Vicky, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hey, good morning. Thank you.
No, Sandra, I can't help but wonder how difficult this week has been for you and for so many others.
It's been surreal. It's been devastating, but it's also been uplifting. Being away from my whole family's in El Paso, so being away from them, the first reaction I had was, oh my gosh, this is not happening. And then mm-hmm. I checked in with them, and it's been an interesting week, whereas I think El Paso is in mourning, like you said earlier, But it's brought the community together as well, I think. So that's the uplifting part of it.
What about the fear factor here? What does it do to the fear level, the fear quotient that so many folks might feel?
You know, I think that for my parents, being in a, I'm a Mexican immigrant, so my parents, we're all immigrants. We all immigrated to El Paso from across, you know, the border in Juarez. And we've been here for almost 2 decades. I think that my parents felt comfortable being in a place that is surrounded by people who look like them, who speak Spanish, who have the same experiences as they are. And for me, that's always been a comforting feeling, being away from Texas, being away from El Paso, especially, where although Latinos are a vast majority, I mean, it's, you know, 18% of the population in the United States. It's always been comforting knowing that my parents are surrounded by people who are like me. And that kind of feeling of comfort is now removed.
That's saying a lot. Yeah. You know, Vicky, I'm wondering about you, how difficult this week has been.
I'd say my husband and I have been in a haze, I would say, and so has our family. That sense of peace and tranquility that El Paso used to have, that safety net, is no longer there.
And it feels maybe it could happen anywhere now?
Yes. We don't feel safe going anywhere, really. I feel as though my identity now is just, it's like people can tell I'm a Latina and that they don't want to talk to me or they hate me, you know?
Is that a change? Is that different now than it was 5, 7 years ago?
Absolutely. I think it has changed tremendously. I felt that when I moved to the Midwest from El Paso. But now it's not, I'm in a new place where I'm now the minority. It's, I'm in a new place, I'm a minority that's hated.
That's hated. Yeah. Want to invite members of the Hispanic community to let us know what they're feeling this week in the wake of the El Paso tragedy. Our number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Just curious if either of you, you've spoken with your family, you're saying, Sandra, what about friends back home, Vicky? How about, have you reached out?
Yes. That Saturday, I think we spent the majority of the day texting people, checking on them. I remember speaking with one of my friends who's from Juarez, and she said those were the longest 20 minutes of my life, just counting heads, making sure that everybody's okay. And the devastation, it's just resonating. It's like a shockwave went through the whole community.
You know, maybe the elephant in the room here, there's been so much talk this week about President Trump's culpability, given his rhetoric that's been going on for any number of years here. Address that for us, Sandra. How much of a factor was that? What do you make of all that in terms of an instigating factor here?
It is totally a factor. The fact that I think that, I mean, I've known that President Trump has fueled the white supremacist rhetoric since he began his campaign for president, right, in 2015. I remember being in South Texas working on a project of oral histories and sitting at a restaurant watching his famous, or now infamous, I guess, when Mexico sends its people, they don't send their best, right? They send rapists and murderers and drug dealers. And to be sitting in a public place that was a border community, and just looking all around with people being shocked at what had come out of someone who was going to represent potentially at that point the presidency of the United States was mind-blowing. And so as
how do you process something like that? How do you grapple with that?
Well, so there's two identities embedded in me, right? The Mexican immigrant, the very proud Mexican who, you know, knows that our people are resilient and powerful and beautiful. And then there's the historian in me, the historian of Chicano, Latino history, borderlands history, that knows this is all part of a cycle. This has been happening since, you know, the Southwest became part of the United States in 1848. It's
just, but this is 2019. Wave. This is a few years down the road from 1848.
Oh, of course. But it's a recurring theme in our American history.
Comes and it goes.
Yes,
it comes and
but
it goes.
I mean, it never truly disappears. I want to say racism never truly disappears. Anti-immigrant, anti-Latino, anti-Black sentiment has not disappeared. But there's moments where society, people, organizations feel that and bring it out into the mainstream to have people who are not maybe identified with these groups who say, whoa, this is not the America I know. But that is the America that a lot of underrepresented groups and minorities have faced day to day, right? So it doesn't disappear. It's just much more pronounced today because of the these ideas of President Trump kind of just approving of, right? Mm-hmm. Even nods, you know, smiles during campaign speeches where people are shouting in Florida, shoot them, right? That is kind of approving of that behavior, incentivizing the for white supremacy to be out in the public. And I mean, I think that before I kind of just quiet down here, you know, sitting down, I was glued to the news on Saturday and Sunday and to this day. And I think Sunday, Jake Tapper on CNN in the morning posted all the instances where Trump had tweeted Hispanic invasion. And that, to me, was so it obviously shows the power that people have and the influence that people have that you don't know that you are going to pass forward to someone, you know?
Vicky, I'm wondering about you and your feelings about the president's rhetoric.
I remember working in the college newsroom when he was still a candidate, and I didn't think that this would ever happen.
That he would become president.
Right, right. I think a lot of us were in disbelief. I remember feeling discomfort, you know, when he was elected, mostly because he targeted my community. And so I had never felt that way, ever. I was a proud Latina walking around, you know, big hoops, whatever. I with my music blasting. And that's, I'm very proud of who I am. But then to have this sense of maybe I shouldn't turn this music on. Maybe I shouldn't wear this shirt that says, you know, I'm a proud Latina. Maybe I shouldn't put this on my Twitter feed because I'm going to be targeted because I'm a journalist.
That's new for you, those feelings you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a heightened sense of awareness of this person that I am. And should I be public facing even, you know?
That makes me sad.
Yeah,
to hear you describe
that.
Sad. Yeah. To what extent does your family talk about the president's rhetoric and what it has meant to them?
My mother is very outspoken and is so disheartened because she says now, even I, a woman, a Latina woman, and she's from Puerto Rico, a Latina woman with blue eyes and brown hair can't walk around without being targeted, without someone assuming that I am who the president says, a rapist, a bad hombre, you know what I mean? All right. Of these different titles that he's given our community.
To what extent do you think all of this is going to manifest itself in people voting next year in numbers, you know, extraordinary numbers?
How is it going to affect the voting population?
Yeah, will more people vote in the Hispanic community given what you're describing to me today?
I really don't know. I don't know.
Do you wonder?
I do. I mean, I'm a naturally curious person,
right,
and I'm
right.
a journalist, so I wonder about that.
You know, Janet Merguia, who once lived in Kansas City, Kansas, and is president of Unidos U.S., formerly the National Council of La Raza, wrote in the New York Times this week that the violence in El Paso is not about immigration policy. It's about promoting the hate, fear, and division sown by President Trump. In the past 3 years, Mr. Trump has systematically sought to paint a hateful portrait of Hispanics. And later in the piece, she writes this, violence is a terrifying but not unexpected outcome when our nation's leader tries to normalize hate. You're both nodding your heads. Yeah.
It's so normalized at this point.
Absolutely. Again, you know, the historian in me knows that this is a recurring theme. Latinos, Mexicans in particular, Mexican Americans have always been scapegoated for the quote-unquote troublesome problems of the United States, right? And in part because I feel that a lot of folks think that Latinos are new immigrants, so they're not part of our mainstream American experience, but there are people. So for me to hear the invasion of Texas, the historian in me was like, open a book, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. There are families that had been there for generations since before Texas was even a part of the United States, right? Mm-hmm. That have been here longer. That is their home, mm-hmm. right? But then, you know, with this scapegoating, you have folks who in the 1930s during the Great Depression, they were scapegoated as taking jobs, right? And Mexicans, close to a million Mexicans and Mexican-Americans, a lot of them who were citizens of the United States, were repatriated to Mexico mm-hmm. to open up jobs for white folks. And this is close to a million people in the 1930s. You have, you know, in, at the, like, 1910s, you know, with the recession, or 2010s, example, 2010s and, like, late 2008 with the recession, mm-hmm. You had the scapegoating of, like, they're taking your jobs, right? It's history doesn't repeat itself, but it follows similar paths, right? Mm-hmm. And this has been happening. It's like a wave, right? A wave of scapegoating. And so when the president normalizes the scapegoating, right, it becomes more dangerous. Again, yeah. The danger has not been, you know, it doesn't go away, but it just, it's an upsurge of a fear and danger that the Latino community can feel today.
I guess what I'm wondering about a little bit, Vicky, mm-hmm. is the path ahead here and what happens now. I mean, we did not have, fortunately, a mass shooting in Kansas City this weekend, but we had a shooting and a loss of life at the First Friday's right. event. And the Star had an interesting editorial this week saying, our response to this should be not to retreat from First Fridays next month, but to show up in mass and to show unity in the face of this kind of violence and discord. And I'm wondering, the Hispanic community, Latinos, what's the path forward going to be, do you think?
The first step, I'd say, is, you know, Sandra and I have connected. I've connected with many people in the community locally who are from El Paso or also consider themselves Latinos or Latinx. And right now we need to care for our community. We need to unite and also think about, you know, how are we going to cope? Mm-hmm. What are the next steps? Mental health is a super important thing that we need mm-hmm. to take care of.
And watch that, yeah.
Yes, yes. And it's sometimes difficult to admit that you're depressed or anxious, but I think the first step is talk to someone you trust. Yeah. Me and my husband talk about it. He is Mexican-American. So we're just going to unite, be together, and we'll see what happens after that.
We'll have to leave our conversation there, and I'm sorry to hear about your feelings, just for sure. Sandra Enriquez, an assistant professor in the Department of History at UMKC. Vicky Diaz-Camacho is the community reporter for Flatland KC, based at KCPT. Thank you both for sharing your views.
Really appreciate this.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, Spencer and Brian here to talk about some fun stuff to do this weekend.
A banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes. Hoping this good food fills ya. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills ya. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Having a derby irby. Look in the fendel mendel. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Well, Spencer Hardwick and Brian McTavish are here to talk about some fun stuff to do this weekend. They're getting their microphones set. They're raring to go. And here we're going to start the race car and take off here. Spencer, tell us about the Crossroads Food Truck Fest.
Absolutely. Some of your favorites will be out there. Boyer's Meatballs, Cheesy Street, Drasco's, The Waffler, The Taste of Brazil, Cowtown Mini Donuts, Russell Stover. Did you know Russell Stover's had a food truck?
I did not, but I like meatballs. I heard the word meatballs and I perked right up.
There you go. Tasty Tasters as well. Brian, what's your favorite food truck?
favorite food truck? Anything
City.
Serving a meatball-related product.
Oh, so we're you're a meatball guy, too. How can got you not it, be?
Well, be careful.
Yeah.
I'll go with Urban Cafe.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this is going on this week, and where can people do all this?
Yes. This is 5 p.m. Saturday in none other than the Crossroads District.
Okay. Sounds like a good time. What in the world do we have here, Mr. McTavish?
Bum, 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 bum.
Yeah, what is this?
Okay, it's KC Paracon. It's where you want to be if you have an interest in the paranormal and metaphysical worlds. 2 to 10:30 Friday, 10 to 8:30 Saturday.
Paranormal.
Yes, let's talk about that. Yeah,
thanks. What are we talking about? Yeah, not your thing.
I don't like ghosts.
Yeah.
Oh, how about
UFOs? Sounds interesting.
How about UFOs, Spencer?
I like them in movies. That's
it could be
it.
Real.
People well, say they see them.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in movie UFOs, but they could be real. People do say they see them. You know somebody who swears they've seen them.
Yeah, of course they have.
So anyway, a little bit more on this. KC Paracon, whatever's out there is out there at the Kansas City Masonic Temple Friday and Saturday. Lots of speakers and lots of vendors, including paranormal investigators and psychic mediums. And you can check out crystals and healing stones. All of this is in the name of getting to know the arguably unknowable, whether it's ghost hunting or UFO chasing or Bigfoot believing.
I bet that would be an interesting place to swing by for a little bit.
You don't have to really believe. You can just be merely curious.
And swing by and see what all that's about.
Oh, so, and real quick.
Yes, sir.
There's something called a cryptid. What's a cryptid? Well, it's a being or plant whose existence has been suggested but not yet proven by science. Such as Bigfoot or UFOs or the Loch Ness Monster.
Bigfoot.
Or
give me a break. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's this weekend.
Let's all go.
This concept absolutely fascinates me, Spencer. I just can't imagine doing this, but it's interesting to me. So what are we talking about?
Well, let's start with this. A lot of people say that the board game is dead. Everything's coming to the apps. First of all, you should check out this place called Pawn and Pint in downtown. It's a bar, and it has about hundreds of board games. So
where
board
is this
game
place?
It's right off of 613 Walnut. Hundreds of board games.
So River Market you're talking about.
River Market area. So they are setting up on Friday night a speed dating night over board games. So if you like games, you can come for that. If you're looking to hop off Tinder for a little bit, you can come in, meet some new people around Kansas City over Sorry, Connect Four, Chess. And they've got the super games that even the nerdiest folks will want to come out and check out.
How is Pawn and Pint doing? Is that place crowded? A lot of people playing board games?
It's been open for, I think, a little over a year now. It's got 4.7 on Google Review. So people love it, love the concept. I try to get my wife to come down. She's not much of a board game person. I am. So if anybody wants to come down there and play me in Connect Four, I will crush you.
What Connect Four?
Yes, that's my game.
What is that game?
So you don't know Connect Four?
I don't know Connect Four.
Oh, man,
no.
I'm speaking
I know Monopoly. Again. Spencer, come on.
Connect Four is a board game where
Clue.
You stack chips. It's kind of like tic-tac-toe, but with four instead of three. We'll start
okay.
there.
Okay. Okay. That sounds pretty good.
Everyone under 35 is doing a face palm right now. That's okay.
Why? That's why you're here. Yeah.
To do is put on this little bikini and dance.
Let's talk bikinis.
Well, if you insist, how to describe Carolyn Rose?
She's talking bikinis.
She's singing bikinis. Let's call her, say, an alternative satirical pop rock singer songwriter. Ding, ding, ding. That's it. Catch Carolyn Rose at 8 o'clock Sunday night at Record Bar. Okay, she is touring clubs right now as we speak in support of her second album, Loner. This tune, which I think you have a liking for, so do I, Bikini. But here's the deal. It tackles the topic of female objectification in popular entertainment.
Ah.
So if you can kind of have it both ways. The video of this song is very interesting. It shows a bunch of normal-looking women in very small bikinis having a great time.
Hmm.
She sings about greed, accidental pregnancy, infidelity, misogyny, isolation, and the harsh reality of one day breathing your last breath. And Steve and Spencer, it's all laced with a quirky yet vaguely ominous sense of absurdity that she calls schizo drift.
Hmm.
No, she's fun.
Schizo drift.
And she dresses in red.
When's the last time you played a board game? I'm going back.
When was the last time I was bored during a board game?
Well, when did you play a board game?
Years ago.
Years ago.
Monopoly. Yes. And here's the thing, Spencer. If you lose, you win with the women.
Oh, okay.
Lose those games, man.
I'm okay. A board game guy.
Okay, here we go.
I'm going to be round my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
We are talking about vegetables here.
Steve, it wouldn't be 2019 if I didn't mention Veg Out, which is a monthly plant-based food and drink festival going on Saturday from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. And I know Kansas City's a big barbecue town, but even places like Charbar, they have the jackfruit. There's more menus around for folks who are really on that vegetarian or vegan diet. So it really is something that's amazing. Come out and celebrate on Saturday.
Do you like vegetables?
I am 5'6", so data would say not as much as I probably should. I've learned to grow into them.
So 5'6" is the you don't eat vegetables. That's why you're 5'6".
That's I think it's a partial factor. I was the guy who managed to put the broccoli in his napkin and throw it in the trash before mom or grandma could take a look. And so that's cost me here on the back end of my.
Well, the guy next to you is about what? What are you, 6'6"?
I am 6'7".
So you like vegetables?
No. The reason I'm 6'7" is I don't touch them.
Oh.
I mean corn, peas, but if it's not in a can, I don't know.
Popeye style.
I like them. I eat them every day, lots of them. Okay, and finally today. That's Fog Hat, but we're not talking about Fog Hat here.
Well, we could, shall we?
No.
Okay, they're all about the slow ride, and this is the weekend. You can take it slow at two totally sweat-free running events this weekend. Each offers the chance to look like you're doing something when, in fact, you're not really doing anything but drinking, most likely. First up, the Underachievers Run 0.5K. That's right, it's a 0.5K in Westport. The runners start at Kelly's Westport Inn around noon.
0.5K.
0.5, baby.
So you're just like doing like 150 yards here or something.
It's about 16,000 inches.
Okay.
Anyway, so you go from one bar to the next. You start out at Kelly's. You go to KC. You wind up at Throwback KC.
Wow.
Main thing is to underachieve and move as little as possible. And we also have the 11th annual Craig Satch Sanders Memorial 0.1K. Point one, you basically walk or stumble or even get in your car and drive around the parking lot. This happens.
That's my kind of case.
Yeah, now you're talking. 11:30 to 4 on Sunday. You can do both of these runs.
Survive them, probably.
And survive them. But anyway, the one on Sunday happens at Patrick's Bar and No Grill.
All right, that's Brian McTavish and Spencer Hardwick with your weekend to-do list. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. KCUR's on Facebook. And go to KCUR.org/Kraske to sign up for our new weekly newsletter. Brian and Spencer are about to do it right now. Tomorrow we speak with the Kansas City Public School Board 1 week before school starts. Join us for that conversation. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.